I'm Brad Shreve, and this is Queer Writers of Crime. Requeered Tales is an awesome publisher that republishes award-winning post-Stonewall gay and lesbian fiction. And this year, they have outdone themselves and are republishing the entire Nick Hoffman academic series by my friend Lev Raphael. So, of course, Lev is back. We have great conversations about Nick Hoffman, the mystery series, as well as all things writing.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
My fans like is the academic satire, the fact that Nick Hoffman is happily married and is not neurotic about being gay. And they love the setting, the physical setting, the Michigan setting. And some people have asked to borrow their cabin up north in Michigan, which I think is really adorable. You know, and to me, that's a success. That means that they think the book is so real that obviously I must have a cabin like that. And I said, I wish.
That means you're doing your job well.
Yes. One other fan said, oh, you should just give them keys and directions and see where they end up. That would be mean, I think.
It's great. Well, I think people should know who I'm talking to. This is Lev Raphael. This is your third time, I think, on the show.
It is indeed. And
yeah.
But I don't think the third time is a charm. I think we had a charming conversation each of the previous times, too.
I think with you more than anyone else, listeners told me, you guys sounded like old pals for decades.
That's what it feels like, yeah.
Yeah, you're very easy to chat with. So anytime the topic comes up of, should we bring Lev back? Well, yeah, let's do, you know, of course. He makes my job easy.
I love it. And I think part of why I'm comfortable doing this is that I had acting experience. I had teaching experience. I was on many book tours and have done hundreds of talks and readings in like, 9 different countries at this point. And most of all, I had my own interview show for 2 years on radio. You know, I got to work with people on the other side and see how it's done. And so this, none of this is foreign or off-putting for me. It feels very natural.
And the interview show that was on PBS, am I correct?
No, it was a public station in Michigan.
Okay, but it was a public radio
station. Yeah, it
was
a public radio station. Yeah, and I got to interview Erica Young and Salman Rushdie. That one, he was amazing, just amazing. Michigan State University's Special Archives has the tapes from that show, the recordings from that show. I actually thought when I was contacted by a publicist asking if I wanted to interview him, I thought it was one of those scams. Like, you know, I'm a Nigerian prince and, you know, I've buried, you know, $9 million worth of gold in Bermuda. And, you know, if you give me your social security number, I'll tell you where it is so we can split it or whatever. I couldn't believe that I was little me was being asked to interview him, but he was brilliant. I thought after that point, I thought, I don't care what happens to the show because I've interviewed one of the greatest writers in the world.
Yeah, that must have been a fascinating conversation.
It was. Yeah, it was Shalimar the Clown was the book we talked about. The book set in, in Kashmir, the disputed region between India and Pakistan. And he's just dazzling. You know, a friend of mine said an essayist, a memoirist said that all he wanted to be, his goal was to be a voice in the choir. And, you know, that's something that I feel when I read books by brilliant writers. I think, well, I'm a voice in this choir. I am a writer too. I don't feel intimidated by them. I feel exhilarated by writing that's so powerful.
And I read something in your blog talking about this. You have a list of your signature lines that you wrote.
Oh, yeah. Goof lines from Dorothy L., the Mystery Readers and Writers Listserv. Yeah. Is that what you're referring to?
No, you have signature lines that you wrote in novels, a list of them.
Oh.
It was done back in 96.
Uh-huh. Ooh, do you have it? I don't even remember.
Well, I'll pull it up while we're talking so I can list them all.
Well, it's funny that you said that because somebody, a fan Well, actually, a writer that I'm working with at writewithoutborders.com, which is my coaching, mentoring, editing website, a writer is reading one of my earlier mysteries. I think the third one, no, the second one, the Edith Wharton murders. And she was saying, oh my God, I love this line and this line and this line. And I look at them and I don't immediately recognize them, and which is cool to be surprised by my own work. The flip side of that is, I met Philip Roth at a reading and asked for his autograph, obviously. And then I gave him one of my books, quoting one of his. And he looked at it disdainfully and he said, did I really write that? And I said, yes, you did. And he said, I wish I hadn't. So I clearly insulted him by bringing up a line that he didn't think was any good, but I thought it was great.
Your first Nick Hoffman book was written in 1996, I believe.
Yes, it came out in 96. Yeah, Let's Get Criminal.
Let's Get Criminal. And first of all, did you have, there's a song with sex in it.
Let's Get Physical. Yeah, that's a,
Let's Get Physical.
That's a reference to the Olivia Newton-John song. There's one point where Nick is just totally kind of losing his mind, and he's driving along, and he's singing in his head, Let's Get Criminal. Criminal, I want to get criminal, because he's been involved in the murder investigation, and I just that was a lot of fun. And then she was still pretty popular back then in 96.
Oh yeah, it worked, because I looked at the title and it didn't do it before, but just recently when I looked at it, I said, Let's Get Physical.
Yep.
I wonder if he did that on purpose.
I certainly did. Yes, I'm glad you caught it.
When you started that novel, did you know it was going to be a series?
I had an inkling, because my editor at St. Martin's Press, the famous Michael Denany, said after I'd published Dancing on Tisha B'Av, my first book of short stories, it won a Lambda Book Award. Actually, it won the Gay Men's Debut. And parenthetically, I have to tell you this. I was afraid of going to the banquet in New York because I was sure I was going to lose. And I didn't want to have one of those Oscar moments where, you know, people would stare at me while I was smiling gamely as someone else took the award.
Yes.
But I did go because my then partner, now husband, said, you have to go because you will never again have a chance to be a debutante. So, I mean, how can you say no to that? And I did win. So he was right. And he also said, if you win and you're not there, you will be bitching about it for the rest of your life. And I said, you know me well, very well. So we went. So did I think it was going to be a series? Michael Denany said in response to, after I worked on the book of short stories with him that got great reviews and Winterized, my first novel, he said, you know, your work is powerful. It's very dark. I mean, obviously it's dark. At the time I was writing a lot of stories about children of Holocaust survivors and the legacy of the Holocaust. And he said, but you have a sense of humor. Why don't you write something funny? And he said, you know, you've seen the Nick and Nora Charles mysteries. And I said, yes, I have. He said, well, why don't you write something funny like that? Now, he didn't specifically say mystery, but that's what I decided to do. Because I was an Agatha Christie fan from probably junior high school on. In fact, my two favorite writers in junior high, aside from school, I mean, what was happening in school was seemed to have very little to do with my life, my creative life, and my life as someone who wanted to be a writer. My two favorite writers were Agatha Christie and Henry James. So that'll tell you something. and I thought, why not take a fish out of water, take a gay man coming to a very straight, very Christian, not Christian capital C, but very non-Jewish environment like the State University of Michigan, and which is the fictional school, and make him the observer. And, you know, an outsider is often the best observer. And so I had this idea for him, and the first two books were in my head. So I didn't know how long I'd be doing the series, but you know, it's continued until this last year, not one a year. I never really wanted to write one a year. And I know from a business point of view, that might not have been the best decision, but from a creative point of view, for me, those books were always a vacation. I'd go back to a place that I knew that was a lot of fun, characters that I knew, and I'd bring in new ones over time, and I'd work in a genre that I really, really admired. You know, that book was my, Let's Get Criminal was my fourth book. I was very nervous about doing a mystery because structurally they're very complicated. I mean, a lot of people still think of them as escapist reading. You know, honestly, every book I read is escapist. I mean, I just want to get away from where I am and enter a different world, whether it's history or biography or poetry or fiction. But I had read so many mysteries and was in awe of people who could pull them off that I only had two books in my head. But then the second one, The Edith Wharton Murders, got me a rave review in the New York Times Book Review, which was a dream come true. And I thought, okay, I'm onto something good. People are really responding to this academic satire. Another story, it's the only time in my life that I can remember actually jumping up and down for joy. When the facts came through from my agent with the New York Times rave review, I was jumping up and down. And then when my husband came back from work, I said to him, this is how nervous I was and unprepared. I said, they can't take it back, can they? They can't withdraw the review. He said, no, 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 that's not what the Times does. No, they might correct a factual error in a report. They don't can reviews after they've been printed. Like, how could they? And I tell you, that review has quotes from that review, pull quotes, have been following the series along ever since, you know. And that's the funny thing. Writers out there will know this. Readers won't. Even if you have a bad review, there's almost always something salvageable from the review that can look really good in when it's excerpted. So for instance, my first book of short stories, someone didn't like, a Jewish magazine didn't like the sex scenes, but thought the stories were really powerful or something about a brand new voice. I don't remember exactly how she ended the review. And the last line or two was really great. And if you read those lines, you don't know that she really didn't like the book, but she liked some aspects of it. So that's the writer's best revenge and the publicist's best revenge and the editor's best revenge and agent too. If a book might get, you know, a mixed review, there's always something you can dig out of it. Unless they said, do not read this book or I will kill you. That one is hard to make into a positive, unless it's comic. I mean, Harlan Ellison was known for writing really funny blurbs. And I think he said something like, if this book were on fire, I wouldn't piss on it to put it out or because it's so, I don't know. He said something really wonderful like that. And that's another thing that writers have to deal with, blurbs, is begging. They have to beg, or their editor or their agent has to beg people for blurbs. And it's still, I have to tell you, it's still kind of humiliating. That's why it's good to have a lot of pull quotes from previous reviews. And the series has consistently gotten good reviews from somebody. I mean, major newspapers. So I don't have to rely on somebody from Goodreads. No offense to Goodreads people, but I don't have to quote some anonymous person in Sioux Falls who said, I love this book. It changed my life.
You know what else can be tough to write? Is a foreword to a novel.
Ah, yes.
And I only say that because I'm going to brag. I did the foreword to The Edith Wharton Murders.
Yes, it was absolutely gorgeous. I'm very grateful. Thank you so much. It's wonderful for me to experience that kind of appreciation and also to see both my book, the specific book, and also my career from somebody else's point of view.
I will say, when you sent me an email and said, can I read it? Because I thought I would just send it off to Recruit Tales and they would put it on there, and you said, can I read it? And I hit send and I was scared shitless.
Yes, because I'm notorious for being a terrible person and I attack people, right? Yeah, absolutely not.
Well, that's why I like to bring you back, because of all the conflict.
Yeah, people have no idea how angry we are at this moment, but we're really stuffing it down. You know, we're good at hiding our feelings, right? Because it's all those years of being gay, right?
I would dread it if they ever heard what we're like when I turn off the record button. It's really ugly.
I used to do a guest stint, I think for about 11 years, on another public radio station in East Lansing. And she and I, it was on Morning Edition. Now she's at Wisconsin Public Radio. Her name's Melissa Ingalls, an amazing reporter. And we always did some kind of warm-up beforehand, and she would put together takeout reels of our warm-up. And one, I completely forgot, we were singing the chorus to Push It from Salt and Pepper. I don't know how that started, but we were going, Push It. Push it real
push
good.
It good.
And I asked her, I said, how did we get into that before going into the book? She said, I don't know, but I loved it.
That's awesome. Well, let's talk about Recreated Tales, because they are republishing. Are they going to republish the whole series?
The whole series, yeah. Burning Down the House is the latest one that they brought out just a few weeks ago. And it marks a bit of a change because Nick has a sexual identity crisis in it. I don't want to give...
I was going to get into it because it's like right at the very beginning. It's hinted. Well, it's more than hinted at.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, he finds himself attracted to a woman for the first time in his life. And it throws his sense of self into, let's say, mild chaos. And I just had a lot of fun with that. My editor at the time thought it would be hilarious for Nick to be dealing with this crisis. Not that that is... It innately funny, but the way Nick approaches it, it is. And this is he's attracted to a foul-mouthed professor of Canadian studies, Juno Drumgoole, who is one of my favorite characters in the series because she's a mix of Bette Midler and Tina Turner, and she is combative, angry, vulgar. She's not what you expect a Canadian person would be like. You know, we have our cliche that Canadians are nice and polite and quiet, and as Americans we do. And so I wanted to play with that cliche. I also played with the cliche, a different sort of cliche, when she and he go gun shopping because he's feeling physically threatened and he goes to a gun store. But it's not like any gun store you've ever been to because it's run by an ex-nurse, a retired nurse, and it's more like a little boutique. And she has pots of potpourri and flowers, and she serves them tea and china cups. And it's just, a number of people have told me they think that's one of the best scenes in the entire series because it just subverts what people expect will happen when Nick goes gun shopping. And I actually did go gun shopping for that book and for another one later in the series, Assault with a Deadly Lie. I went to a gun range and I took a gun safety course, and it turned out I'm actually a pretty good shot, which I think I inherited from my father. But that was really mind blowing. That was just so out of my realm of possibilities, I guess. I never thought I'd even be holding a gun, but I thought if I'm bringing guns into this series, then I have to know what I'm doing and I have to be able to describe what they feel like, what firing a gun is like, how Nick feels about it, how Stefan feels about it. And see, I think that's one of the great things about being a mystery writer. And I tell this to people when I do mystery workshops, I said, if you are a mystery writer, you will meet, there's a good chance you will meet more types of people than you would ever meet writing in any other genre, because you will have to consult experts in any number of things, lawyers, people, medical examiners for forensic details. You'll probably have to talk to cops at some point, firemen, emergency workers, EMT workers. I mean, a whole range of people that you're not likely to meet in any of the social circles that you're in. Maybe one or two, but not all of them. I mean, and you obviously you have to be really well prepared with your questions, otherwise you're wasting their time. But one thing you discover is that people love talking about what they do.
Mm-hmm.
If you're appreciative, curious, and prepared, I've had fascinating discussions with defense lawyers, with medical examiners, with all kinds of experts. And one of my sources in the book is a former police detective who is now a private investigator. So he sees different sides of the criminal world, and he's just amazing to talk to.
Well, I'm speechless because what you're implying is that you research for your novels.
Absolutely. Well, I research for everything I do, and sometimes it takes me a couple of years. It helped that people locally in and people in Michigan knew who I was. And so there wasn't any suspicion. I've talked to wannabe mystery writers or people who are just starting out. And I say, you know, people will be really kind to you. You do not have to worry. Say who you are, what you're doing, that you will acknowledge them in the acknowledgments of the book. And you do they have time for an interview? I've never heard of anyone saying no.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's, you know, like I said, I think doing the research for writing a mystery is just wonderful. It's wonderful fun. But I think I've, in one way or another, I've researched every one of my books. And it's not because I'm an escaped academic. It's just I love to read. I love to learn something new.
My second book is A Body on the Hill. A lot of people say A Body on a Hill. And no, it's very specific hill. It's the hill where the Hollywood sign is.
Oh, right. The Hollywoodland sign originally, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I had been to the Hollywood sign a long, long time ago. And so I said to my husband, we need to go up there if I'm going to write this book.
Right.
It took several tries. But when I got up there, it looked pretty much as I remembered it.
Uh-huh. What, had anything changed? Anything changed from when you first saw it?
Well, yes. And that it changed in the sense that I stopped and had a long conversation with one of the park rangers.
Okay.
And let's just say he really burst my bubble, because what I wanted to happen where the body was placed.
He said that wouldn't happen. That's not possible, or?
Yes, because their security had been so updated since I was there the last. They have helicopters. They have every kind of movement camera. People still climb it because it's only a misdemeanor.
Right.
And to them, it's worth it to get a picture to send home. So they'll climb the fence and get up and get on one of the letters or stand in front of one of the letters so a friend can take a picture. And they get arrested very quickly or taken in, and they get a misdemeanor. So to them, it's worth it.
Right.
I didn't want a misdemeanor. So I didn't. Well, actually, I'm sorry. I couldn't have the killer take the victim up to the sign just because he was only concerned it was a misdemeanor.
A very concerned killer. I really can't mess up my police record anymore. One more misdemeanor and it's curtains for me. Oh, I love that.
Well, when I was talking to him, he said, I hope you're prepared to write a different novel. And I said, no, I'm just going to change it. And unfortunately, I have to change it a hell of a lot more than I want to. And so I'm curious, in your experience, in your research, have you ever had an expert burst your bubble?
I haven't had experts do quite that. I almost always find that situations are far more complicated than I realize. Like in Assault with a Deadly Lie, which is later in the series, I heavily relied on info about SWAT teams and also misdemeanors and felonies. And I had some ideas in my head, and a defense attorney told me, no, that's not how the law works. That's not. And she said, this is what I would do. So sometimes what I, and I've actually dedicated my 10th book in this series to her. She said, that's not exactly how it would work. This is how it would work. And then so I said, can I send you an actual scene? It's only a page. Are these the things that she would say? And that's something that I often ask experts. Is this something you would say? You know, I might have my idea based on things I've read or movies or TV shows that I would like to hear it from an expert who is practicing in that field. Is this something you're likely to say? Because I want my dialogue to be as realistic as possible. And oftentimes they say, no, I wouldn't say that.
I did research on the history of the Hollywood sign. And because I was going to sprinkle a little bit of that in my novel, and people know because it's been in the movies and TV in most recent years, the sign did originally say Hollywood Land. There's this incredibly cute little neighborhood below the sign.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. And if you read their original flyers, they are not too subtle about the fact that that neighborhood was built so they could keep out the blacks and the Mexicans.
Are you kidding? Wow.
It's hinted at, but it's pretty damn obvious. But it's adorable. It's just adorable. So anyway, the sign kept falling down over the years, and they left up the word Hollywood. You know, so I'm researching a lot more than I need to. And there's a story about the letter H, because it was one of the first signs to fall down. And I think it was in the 30s it happened. When the sign fell down, or the H fell down, there are stories that say the caretaker of the sign was a heavy drinker and he lost control of his car and drove it down the hill and ran into the H.
Oh, wow.
And then there are those that insist that is untrue, that never happened. And so I kept researching, and I couldn't find really what happened. I couldn't find proof that it did happen. I couldn't find that it didn't happen. So, of course, I chose the more fun one.
Yes.
And had that in there.
Right.
I ended up describing the sign way too, the history of it way more than I needed to. So I took that out, but it really hurt. It really hurt because I wanted that to be in there because I think it was just a great story. And I hope it is true.
I hope so, too. That's wonderful. Well, when you started talking about the H falling over, I was thinking, that's a big letter. How did he do that? How did the guard do that?
Well, those letters have all fallen down at one point or another. They have wanted to tear that sign down for decades. And for one reason or another, either people would get together to pull money together to bandage the sign. And it wasn't until the 70s or 80s that a lot of celebrities got together to replace the old wooden sign with...
Okay. So it's metal or plastic or something? What is it?
I think it's metal. In fact, I know it is because when you hike, you're actually behind the sign.
Uh-huh.
And it is metal. But for years and years, it was wooden. And they just kept bandaging it. And they were really... It was on the verge of being torn down.
Wow.
And because it was determined unsafe. And that's when these different celebrities, I think Alice Cooper actually was one of them. Each celebrity bought a letter.
Huh.
And all of them could tell you why they bought that specific letter. Do I remember off the top of my head now? No. So is it sometimes difficult to, when you do your research, to pick and choose what you want to use and what you don't?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but it's better in early drafts to put in everything and then trim. That's what I find. I may have extra paragraphs, but it's nice to have that because I have a friend who has the opposite problem. She has a novel that's too short, and her agent said, well, you've got to write 20,000 more words. Well, out of what? From where? I mean, you know, that's...
You don't want to stick fluff in there.
No. So that's a lot of words. That's a lot of pages to write. If you've written the book the way you want it to be, how are you going to redo it? I mean, that's problematic. So, you know, we all have our favorite pieces. I'll tell you one thing. I once had a book with Walker Walker and Company, and the editor, Michael Seidman, said, because Walker lured me away from St. Martin's Press, said that the book is too long. And I said, well, how long? And he said, it's 100 pages too long. And I said, oh, that's a lot of pages. And he said, well, you need to cut 100 pages. And I said, any advice? He said, no, just cut anywhere. So, you know, I tell all the people I work with at writewithoutborders.com, and when I do mystery, when I do master classes or writing workshops, nothing you write is ever wasted. Just keep it in a file. And so I cut more like almost 100 pages, and I was able to recycle about 75 pages of it elsewhere in the series. So, and it was a perverse kind of fun because it was a real challenge. Can I really do this? You know, at first I was shocked, and then I thought, well, I'm a professional writer. I mean, I may have to do this some other time with some other book. So I need to, you know, I need to be strategic and get it done. And I did it in a month. And I was really pleased that, and I'm happy with the book the way it is, and happy that I was able to recycle some of it. And I won't say which book it is.
No, don't do that. And actually, there's a quote, and I wish I could remember who it's attributed to. And you know, when quotes float around you.
Oh, Mark Twain said everything, right? Yeah.
Oh, he sure did. Yes, he did.
Even if it sounds like Mark Twain or Oscar Wilde, even if it sounds like something from a greeting card, you're bound to see it on Google Images or in Goodreads or something. You know, they were still writing after they were dead, obviously.
You know, it was just a few weeks ago I found a website that listed quotes attributed to
that
Mark
are fake.
Twain.
Yes, yes. I have that site.
Yes, yeah. And it was like, he never would have read.
Well, and that's what amazes me is that people will post something. I did a blog about this. I more than one blog when I was writing at the Huffington Post, people will attribute something to Oscar Wilde that is so banal and so badly written and so empty. He would never say, he'd be embarrassed to say that, you know, ditto Twain. But those two tend to be magnets for fake quotes.
Absolutely. Twain especially.
Usually by people who have not read either writer, so they don't know what those writers might sound like. I think that's one of the problems.
I think you're right there. So the quote that I was going to give you that I can't remember who it's attributed to, you may have heard this before. Person, whoever they were famous, wrote a letter. And in the letter they said, I apologize this letter is so long. I didn't have time to write a shorter letter.
Who do they attribute it to?
I can't recall. But it's a pretty good quote.
Well, there's one from Mark Twain that I see a lot. The secret of getting ahead is getting started. The secret of getting started is breaking your complex, overwhelming tasks into small, manageable tasks and then starting on the first one. I mean, could anything...
That sounds just like Twain to me.
Yeah. Could anything be blander, less juicy, with less character? I mean, it's just something that you might find in a flyer at some business workshop. I mean, or some weekend retreat. It's just awful. I mean, Twain didn't say anything like that. But there's a whole school of people watching out for fake Twain quotes, which I think is interesting, like that website you said mentioned. And people really are guardians of his legacy. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I remember that he said. Oh, this is my favorite one. And it always has a picture of violets. Forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it.
That's supposed to be Twain?
Yep. I see it all over. I've seen it on Facebook. I've seen it on Twitter. I've seen it on Google Images. And it's something out of a romance novel. You know, it's not anything Twain would ever
yes.
said. It may be a wonderful line at the end of a romance, and nothing against the genre. I mean, I would love to be able to write a romance. I've never come up with a good plot and something that would drive me forward into the book. You know, and romances and mysteries are two of the most popular genres out there for readers. But, you know, Violet's crushed. Oh, my God. You know, it's so and it has a touch of the smarmy to it. You know, it's just a little too sweet. And Twain was had a mouth on him. Twain was really sarcastic.
You know, I'm rethinking this, and I think you're wrong, because I distinctly remember that about a third of the way into Huck
yes,
Finn.
Yes, Huck Finn said that. Oh, and this is the worst one. The two most important days in your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why. Well, duh, you find out why because your parents had sex. I mean, that's a shock, right, when you figure that out, and that you were just a sperm and an egg. I mean, that's a lot to absorb when you're a kid. But really, Twain, I mean, honestly, and there is a website, I think, called Quote Investigator, where if anyone out there finds a quote that they think is dubious, go on Quote Investigator, and someone else has probably asked the question, did so-and-so really say this? Usually not. But that person the person running that website will do their best to track where that showed up in popular culture. And that actually is a lot of fun to see how quotes entered the culture and were requoted and just passed along as the wisdom of somebody famous.
There is a meme that floats around Facebook. You see it every now and then. Don't believe because it's on Facebook that it's true. Signed, Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, I love that one. Oh, could you imagine how the Civil War would have had a whole new layer of horror if there had been Twitter and Facebook? Can you imagine, like, after a general loses a battle, the Twitter war would have been merciless. As if the battle wasn't bad enough, the Twitter war would have just put him in his grave.
Let's get to Let's Get Criminal again.
Okay.
Or I'm sorry, Burning Down the House.
And the title is obviously inspired by the Talking Heads. And a lot of titles in my fiction and elsewhere have come from songs by the Talking Heads or obviously Olivia Newton-John, David Bowie. For some reason, I was born with genes that absorb song quotes and song lines. And so things will often just go through my head. And I gave that to Nick Hoffman as one of his characteristics. He's a lot more nervous than I am, though, I have to say. And he takes things with less aplomb than I'm used to taking them.
Yeah, you're pretty ballsy.
Well, he's, you know, I made him miserable because, which is a lot of fun, because he doesn't have tenure. His partner is the writer in residence and has more prestige than he does. Nick loves teaching basic composition because he thinks it's an important aspect of his English department. And everybody looks down on him because of those things. And the book that he wrote, his major book is a bibliography, a secondary bibliography of Edith Wharton, which means it includes everything he could find in any language ever written about Edith Wharton from the beginning of her career till the date of the publication of the book or close to it. And it's a very useful guide for students and scholars, but it's not an abstruse book that only three people are going to read because it costs $149 and will only be bought by a few libraries. So he has a lot that he has to overcome just to get tenure. And then, of course, you know, the university frowns on you getting involved in murders because, as he says it more than once, a university feels about bad publicity as vampires feel about sunlight. You know, they don't want to be exposed. And that, and I have seen that. I mean, and I know academics across the country, and that is absolutely true. Bad PR is something that every university despises, and they will do anything possible to avoid it. So back to burning down the house.
I love that Recur Tales is republishing the series. What made you decide to do that?
They contacted me and...
But you said yes.
I said yes. Well, I had gotten the rights. I had slowly been getting the rights back to them, and I had launched a bunch of them myself on Kindle and Nook. And, you know, I was very happy to have a dedicated team taking over the work of that. It's a lot of work to self-publish, even though the books had already been published. I mean, I was in effect starting a new business. And I was very happy to have somebody take the torch and somebody who really cared about the series and was committed to doing all of them. So saying yes to them was a no-brainer.
It was because of them that I started reading the Nick Hoffman series.
I'm very grateful.
I believe I've said it, and I actually believe it's true. He's tied with my favorite sleuth. There's Nick, and then there's Bernie Rodenbaugh in Lawrence Block.
Yes. Oh, I love the Lawrence Block books. This is so good.
And whichever one is my favorite depends on which one I'm reading.
Yep. His dialogue, his ear for dialogue is really wonderful, I think. And he was a hoot. I'm meeting him at mystery conferences. That was a great thing. For a long time, I was on dozens of panels at mystery conferences of all kinds as a panelist or moderator. I met bestsellers of all kinds. I met just writers starting out like me and met fans too. And it was a wonderful world because I found that mystery writers, crime fiction writers, did not take themselves as seriously as literary writers did, or poets even. They did not think they were writing the great American novel, which didn't mean they weren't dedicated to their craft to the utmost, but they were more fun to hang out with. They just had better senses of humor. And this was writers from around the world. And I spoke at the St. Hilda's Mystery Conference at Oxford and sat with P.D. James and Ann Perry and Val McDermid and just, you know, some of the greatest crime writers alive. And they were all very natural, very, very well educated in the genre and in other things. I have to tell you a story about checking in. So I'm at Oxford. As you've seen in movies, there's a little station, I don't know what, a shed or whatever you call it, where the porter is, right, at the gate to the college. Mm-hmm. And I walk into my room and I think, holy shit, there are two beds here. two single beds. I asked for a single room. I really don't want to share a room with somebody that I haven't met. And so I go down to the porter's lodge, that's what it's called, and I say, I noticed that there are two beds in my room. Am I going to be sharing that room with someone? And he looked at me and smiled and said, well, that's not for me to say, sir. Now, is it? Which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And I said, I will quote you someday. And here I am quoting him. I just loved it, you know. And that conference was amazing. I mean, I sat talking, Val McDermott and I at one point sat by the river and had a 3-hour talk about life and love and writing. And it was amazing. I actually, she rescued me. It was really hot. And you know, the English are not big on air conditioning. And it must have been over 90 in a very crowded room. And she rescued me because I think I was about to pass out. And she leaned, whispered to me, and she said, I think you need some fresh air. And she kind of quietly got me out of the room. However, not quietly enough, because when I asked Robert Barnard, the late Robert Barnard, to sign some of my books that I brought with me, he said, and yet you didn't stay for the entirety of my talk. And I said, well, I explained, I think that was good for everyone in the room, because I think if I had passed out, it would have interrupted your talk and stolen your thunder. And he said, you do have a point. And Val became somebody I was in contact with over the years. And then when I taught for 6 weeks at Regent's College in London, I invited her to speak to my fiction class. We read one of her, actually not one of her mysteries, but one of her collections of short stories. And she was just brilliant. My students absolutely loved her. And I think at Magna Cum Laude, I introduced her once. I think I was the master of ceremonies and led a chant, because at the time, the New York Times said, she's the best we've got. And I quoted that review. And I said, everybody now, she's the best we've got. And we all chanted, a whole room full of people chanted that. I might have had maybe one drink too many to do that, but everybody thought it was wonderful. So there you go. And she was thrilled in her Scottish way.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You were talking about writers not taking themselves too seriously. I find writers, mystery writers, incredibly approachable.
Yes.
And I was trying to write my first novel, everyone was willing to help me.
Yes.
I didn't take any one person's their time. I asked a lot of different people. But Val McDermott is a good example. Every Thursday, we have a book recommendation done, and I have three people that rotate the book. And I'm going to give it a spoiler alert. One of the upcoming books is Individuals is going to give a book recommendation by a Val McDermott novel. And we have to re-record it. We already did it, and we have to re-record it. And the reason why, she wrote Val a letter asking, or an email, letter, who does that? She sent her an email asking her some questions.
Uh-huh.
And she never heard back. So as she's doing this book recommendation, she keeps saying, I think that, or maybe she, and it was a lot of conjecture in it.
Right, right.
And then she sent me an email and she said, Brad, I heard back from Val McDermott. And
oh, how cool.
She answered all my questions. And I said, well, should we record a section of it? And I'll try and fit it in. She goes, let's just do it again. Because she was so thrilled that she never dreamed that she would hear back from her.
That's exactly my entrance into the mystery world in the mid-90s was, I felt the same thing. I was, I crossed paths with Walter Mosley, who was already really famous in Houston at the Jewish Book Fair, because, you know, he's half Jewish. And we had drinks after his reading, and he talked about how he was going to keep his series alive, how he's going to stay interested, what the challenges were. I mean, he was full of advice. I mean, he didn't have to spend any time with me at all, but he was just terrific. And I would say that about almost every single writer of note that mystery writer or thriller writer that I've read has been absolutely just charming, funny, approachable. As I mentioned, we don't take ourselves that seriously. I mean, we take our work seriously, but we don't think we are on a pedestal.
I found it interesting. I think right after my first novel, I mean, I only have two novels, so, you know, I'm no big whoop, but right after my first novel, I was sent a message or on Messenger, somebody just sent me a message to say how much they enjoyed the novel. And I wrote them back, and it was a pretty long email, not huge, but they sent back and said, I'm so shocked. I never thought an author would respond to me. And I'm like, I wrote one damn book.
I have gotten...
It was kind of exciting, but...
Listen, I have written back to everybody who has ever written to me, unless they sounded like potential stalker, which one person did, or they sounded a little weird and I was uncertain. And that's because when I was 12, I read a sort of young adult crime novel set in Paris. All I remember now is that the kid's name was Ziggy. And I just wrote a letter to the author via the publisher, and he wrote back from France. I mean, I was astounded that he wrote back to me. And I already wanted to be a writer myself. And I thought, I will write to everybody who writes to me. I'll tell you, I won't say which editor at which house, but an editor once said to me, really? Isn't that a waste of time? I said, no, it is not. I mean, if you want to look at it from a strictly business standpoint, of course you want to interact with your fans. But from a personal standpoint, if somebody took the time even to write an email, how hard is it to respond? Mm-hmm. I mean, they took time out of their day and they liked your work enough to write to you. And for everybody who actually does that, there could be hundreds of people who are afraid to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Bringing up Lawrence Block, I actually sent him an email. I was asking him some questions and he responded the next day. And I was so thrilled
that's
that I
wonderful.
Heard back
that's
from Lawrence
wonderful.
Block. Yeah, it was very exciting. It was very exciting. Going to Lawrence Block, you were talking about him at a conference. When you go to these conferences and you've given out a very impressive list of people that were at them, are you viewed as a gay author?
Wow. You know, I don't think necessarily. Okay, I remember I once, do you know about the Outright conferences, the gay literary conferences from the early 90s? I remember I was at one, I think in Boston. There's actually a new anthology out that pulls together the keynote speeches from that conference. It's just called Outright. And and they had people like Edward Albee, and Edmund White, very famous writers there. Michael Nava said that his reading of his fan mail was that his fan base was mostly middle-aged women. And that is, I think, the fan base for a lot of people. And that is, publishing experts will tell you that those are the people who buy the most books. So am I viewed as a gay writer? Probably more so by people who are gay or lesbian or trans or bi. Certainly by other writers, I'm seen as just another writer who happens to be writing about a queer sleuth. But we talk about craft and trade, and being gay doesn't really come up. And I think that's one thing that's really interesting to me, and that Michael Nava clued me into, was that mystery fans are very small C Catholic in their tastes, that they read very widely. They read a lot. I mean, some read a book a day, and they want to experience different worlds than their own, much more so than people who will say, oh, I would never read a book that's dated, or I would never read a book by a woman who is writing about a man, or a man who's writing about a woman. Oh, people who have these very narrow limits of what they would read. Mystery fans tend to read very broadly. I mean, if they like historical novels, they don't just read about crime fiction set in the Victorian era. They will read, Stephen Saylor writing about Rome. They will read C.S. Harris writing about the Regency. They span decades, they span centuries. And I think that's one of the joys for me about having written or writing a crime fiction series, is that people come to my books from so many different places.
There are fans of this show that just love this show. And so we communicate back and forth. I've never met them, but they'll send me emails and I'll do the same thing back. And I am always amazed because they are avid mystery readers. And they'll tell me the list. And then they'll start pulling books out of the blue, like you said, that aren't mysteries.
Right.
And I'm like, my God, how do people have that much time?
Well, you know, I think it, if you're a reader, if books feed you, you make the time. That's just, and, you know, people are still, you know, the death of the book, the death of the short story, the death of publishing, the death of X, Y, or Z. I mean, people are still reading, still buying books, still reading. You know, we haven't become half-literate savages. Not yet, anyway.
Well, you're an example of somebody that just blows my mind. And what that is, I'll see an author who is just a great author, has a lot of books they put out, teaches like you teach, and then they start talking about this great series on Netflix.
I love watching a series. Partly, it's part entertainment, but it's also part education. I love seeing a series and how other writers do their character arcs. I really enjoy that. And that partly it's because when I started the mystery series, I was determined that Nick would change over time. And so would his partner, Stefan, that they wouldn't be static, you know. So, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but for me, I didn't want Nick to discover a body and then go out to Denny's and have, you know, breakfast and not be untouched by it. I wanted him to be changed as I would be, or most people would be, by the shock of encountering death so close to hand. Also being a suspect and being not just being a suspect, but having to deal with homophobia from the campus police. I wanted Nick to really experience change and pressure and chaos very directly, rather than have him stay the same person. You know, and my husband and I both watch a lot of TV and movies. And one of his complaints, when he says, you know, I really don't want to stick with this series, and I'll know where he's going, and he'll say the characters haven't changed. You know, they're not growing, they're not learning anything. They're just the same people. And, you know, I usually agree with him. Although he has some more patience for things that don't work, because he finds them more amusing than I do. So we make a good team, because he'll report back to me on what's been going on. Like if I give up on a series, I'll say, but you need to pay attention to it because I want to know how it ends. He will tell me.
I find it very hard to find the time to watch television. I'm not a huge television watcher anyway. I'm more likely to watch YouTube because
right.
I can watch something in 15 minutes and be done with it. And I'm not talking about mindless stuff. I'll watch that too.
You mean like cats being washed in the sink, right?
Yeah, exactly.
One day I came into a class that I was teaching at Michigan State University, and it was a creative writing class, and everybody's laughing and they're looking at their laptops or their phones. And I said, "What's so funny?" And it was, I don't know, a pig chasing a duck.
Yeah.
And I said, "Okay, that's funny. How can you use that in your writing?" So we had actually a really good discussion. And people talked about different possibilities about how they could work that into a story or a scene or what it would say about a character. So, but pigs and, you know, although I do like to watch, I have two West Highland White Terriers. So I confess I will watch Westies playing on YouTube every now and then. I can't do it when they're home because it drives them nuts. Because they see dogs gamboling on the screen and they start barking.
Well, it's funny to me that you brought up that you like watching writers and that sort of thing, what they do on television. I knew I wanted to be a writer way before I did this, but probably my earliest writings were episodes of Gilligan's Island.
Oh, really?
And what's interesting, I wrote them as dramedies.
Rather than straight comedy.
And that was before dramedies ever existed. I thought, no, what would people really experience? And you know, because it wasn't just like one person. We always read about one person trapped on an island or the Swiss Family Robinson. They kind of had a little community.
Yes, they did.
And so that's kind of what I wrote. Like, how would they get their separate lives in addition to being stranded with these different individuals? And
uh-huh.
I had a lot of fun with that. I'm sure they're absolute garbage. I wish I had them somewhere.
So you were doing fan fiction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I changed the whole show. So that was a lot of fun. And I hate it because you and I could go for days talking.
But we're done.
It is time to wrap up the show.
Now it's time to say goodbye to all our company. M-I-C-K-Y-M-O-U-S-C. And I'm quoting them because the CEO is has criticized DeSantis and the Don't Say Gay law. So I think Mickey Mouse is up there as one of my heroes now.
Well, and before I let you go, when I was reading your novel, it was mentioned about being fluid sexually. You had that in there. And I was like,
right.
Wow, you wrote that before. That was a common thing. But I'll tell you what it made me think of. The theme song to All in the Family, Girls Were Girls and Men Were Men. That song started playing in my head when I read it. Now it's going to be in my head all day. But anyway.
Those were the days, right? That was the song that.
Yes, those were the days.
Yeah, they banged it out on an upright piano.
Well, thank you again for being back.
Oh, it was great talking to you.
I look forward to the fourth time.
Yes, me too. Take care.